Did you know a 2018 study showed half of prenatal vitamins tested had unacceptable levels of heavy metals? I'm Kat, mother of three and founder of Ritual. When I was 4 months pregnant, I couldn't find a prenatal I could trust, so I created my own. Ours is made traceable, third-party tested for heavy metals, and recently earned the Purity Award from the Clean Label Project. But don't just take my word for it. Get 25% off at ritual.com/prenatal.
Okay, round two. Name something that's not boring.
A laundry? Ooh, a book club. Computer solitaire, huh?
Ah, oh, sorry. We were looking for Chumba Casino. That's right. Chumbacasino.com has over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
It is Ryan here, and I have a question for you. What do you do when you win? Like, are you a fist pumper, a woo-hooer, a hand clapper, a high-fiver? I kind of like the high-five, but if you want to hone in on those winning moves, check out Chumba Casino. At ChumbaCasino.com, choose from hundreds of social casino-style games for your chance to redeem serious cash prizes. There are new game releases weekly, plus free daily bonuses, so don't wait. Start having the most fun ever at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void or prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Judy was boring.
Hello.
Then Judy discovered ChumbaCasino.com.
It's my little escape.
Now Judy's the life of the party.
Oh, baby, mama's bringing home the bacon.
Whoa, take it easy, Judy. The Chumba life is for everybody. So go to ChumbaCasino.com and play over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Welcome to 10 Minute Murder, Brief and Bingeable True Crime. I'm Joe, the host. Thank you for joining today. And what you're joining right now is part two of the two-part episode on the Boston Strangler. If you haven't listened to the first part, stop this one right now and go back and listen to the first part and get caught up with what's going on. We're going to launch right into part two right now. A 55-year-old dressmaker and devout churchgoer by the name of Anna Slessers was the first victim of the killings on June 14, 1962. She was alone in her apartment at 77 Gainsborough Street in Boston. Anna was home, waiting to be picked up by her son, Juris, and taken to a memorial service. When he discovered her body in the bathroom with a cord wrapped around her neck and tied into a bow, Juris assumed that she had committed suicide. Slessers was discovered by homicide investigators John Driscoll and James Mellon in an obscene state, naked and devoid of any dignity. She had been sexually abused. Her purse and its contents were scattered across the floor, giving the apartment the appearance of having been ransacked. A gold watch and other valuable items were left behind, despite what might have been a robbery. The authorities came to the conclusion that it was a failed burglary. 85-year-old Mary Mullen was discovered dead in her house June 28, 1962, just under 3 weeks later. The autopsy initially reported that Mullen died of a heart attack. Nina Nichols, age 68, was also found dead in Boston's Brighton neighborhood 2 days later. Even though the very valuable silver seemed to be untouched and ignored, it once more looked like a burglary. Detectives were puzzled by the ransacking's apparent lack of logic. Miss Nichols was discovered undressed with her stockings tied in a bow. Then, on the same day, a second body was discovered a few miles north of Boston in the suburb of Lynn. Helen Blake was a 65-year-old divorcee, and her murder was more gruesome. She had suffered lacerations to her genitals. Again, the bow trademark was evident, this time made from tying her bra around her neck. Like the previous crimes, the scene appeared, on the surface, to be a burglary. Boston knew that they had a serial murderer wandering the streets after this, and it was obvious. As a result of the gravity of the situation, Boston's female population was issued a warning by Police Commissioner Edmund McNamara, who also canceled all police leave that was scheduled. In addition to being cautious around strangers, women were urged to lock their doors. Using profiling techniques, the police already determined that they were most likely searching for a psychopath whose hatred of elderly women may actually be related to his own relationship with his mother. The worries McNamara had were soon unfortunately validated. On August 19th, a gruesome fifth murder occurred in Boston's West End at Seven Grove Garden. Ida Erga, a 75-year-old widow, was the victim. She was lying on her back on the ground, suffocated, and only covered by a torn brown nightgown that revealed her naked body. Her legs were spread out and supported by two chairs, and the killer had placed a pillow under her backside. As was common with these crime scenes, there was no evidence of forced entry. The killer was apparently invited inside. Less than 24 hours later, Jane Sullivan's lifeless body was discovered at 435 Columbia Road in Dorchester, close to the first victim. The 65-year-old nurse was discovered dead in the bathroom after being killed a week earlier. Her own nylons had choked her to death. Boston was gripped in terror at this time as residents dreaded another attack, but it took the strangler 3 months to carry out his next one. The victim this time was much younger. Sophie Clark, an African-American student in her early 20s, was very cautious about her safety, to the point where she hardly ever dated anyone. On December 5, 1962, her body was discovered not far from where Slessers lived, the first victim. Sophie had been sexually assaulted before being strangled to death with her own stockings. Authorities found semen for the first time. Sophie Clark had been cautious and taken measures for her own safety, but for some unknown reason, she had still allowed the murderer inside. The police were certain it was the same killer, even though Clark did not match the same profile as the other victims. This time, they also had a potential clue for the killer's identification. Police were notified by a neighbor who said a man knocked on her door and claimed to have been sent to paint her home. She told the man that her husband was sleeping in the next room, so the guy bounced. He took off. 3 weeks later, a tragic end to the life of another lady. When Patricia Bassett, 23 years old, was discovered dead in her apartment close to where the Slessers and Clark lived, she was 8 months pregnant. Bassett didn't show up for work, which was very unlike her, so they called the police. She had been also sexually assaulted and strangled with her own stockings as her body was left on the bed and covered in sheets. While it seemed like the city had been spared from another attack for a while, the police frantically searched for any connections between the ladies and anyone they might have mutually known. Interviews and records checks were conducted on every sex offender listed in the Boston Police Archives, but nothing was found. We're talking about the early 60s here. It's not like you could just type some stuff into a computer and it quickly spits out the info you're looking for. It took real people a lot of time to look through a mountain of files and folders. Soon after, a new string of homicides began. This time, in March of 1963, 25 miles outside of the city, the body of Mary Brown, age 68, who had been raped and strangled, was discovered. Beverly Simmons, the 10th victim, was discovered 2 months later. On May 8th, the day of her murder, the 23-year-old recent graduate had skipped choir rehearsal. Simmons was discovered with one of her scarves used to tie her wrists behind her back. She was wearing two handkerchiefs and a nylon stocking around her neck. Strangely, she had a piece of cloth covering her lips while a different piece of cloth was stuffed inside of her mouth. Instead of being strangled, she died from four cuts to the neck. Her body had been stabbed a total of 22 more times, with 18 of those wounds appearing as a bullseye on her right breast. Even though she had been violated, there was no trace of semen. It was believed that the murderer had to resort to stabbing her rather than strangling her because of her strong throat muscles from singing. The cops were so desperate for information at this time that they even enlisted the help of a clairvoyant. It was an escaped mental patient from Boston State Hospital on the days the murders occurred, according to the clairvoyant's description of the killer. When another homicide occurred, this theory was quickly discarded. The most recent victim was 58-year-old divorcee Evelyn Corbin on December 8, 1963 in Salem. On her bed, face up, Corbin was left there naked and lifeless. Again, there were signs of semen in her mouth and on some lipstick stains. As with previous crime scenes, an attempt at a robbery had been staged. In the Lawrence neighborhood, a 23-year-old industrial designer, Joanne Graff, was raped and murdered on November 25th. Many of her attacker's characteristics mirrored those of the man who had been hired to paint Sophie Clark's neighbor's apartment. A guy was described as wearing dark green slacks, a dark shirt, and a jacket. Two women stumbled across their roommate's body on January 4, 1964, leading to the discovery of one of the most horrifying murders. Mary Sullivan was found with her back against the headboard of the bed. A dark stocking had been used to suffocate the 19-year-old. A broom handle had been used to physically assault her. A Happy New Year card was jammed between her feet, and a scarf was tied in a bow around her neck. Her ransacked home had nearly nothing taken. A top investigator was brought in to lead the search for the strangler to try to quell the fear that gripped the city. The highest-ranking law enforcement official in the state of Massachusetts, Attorney General Edward Brooke, started his investigation into the serial murderer on January 17, 1964. Since Brooke is the only black attorney general in the nation, there is an added pressure on him to achieve where others had failed. Brooke oversaw a task force that assigned permanent employees to the Boston Strangler probe. John Bottomley, an unconventional deputy attorney general, was the person he hired. Tens of thousands of pages of documentation from different police departments had to be sorted through by the team under Bottomley. Even though the police profiling was still in its inception in the early 1960s, they still were able to come up with what they thought were the killer's most likely traits. He was a hands-on worker who was presumably a loner, about 30 years old, neat and orderly, and who might have been divorced or in a relationship that had broken up. In fact, the killer ended up being found by chance, not by the work of the police force. After a time in prison for breaking and entering, DeSalvo went on to commit more serious crimes. He had broken into a woman's apartment, tied her up on the bed, and held a knife to her throat before molesting her and running away. The victim gave the police a good description, one that matched his likeness sketch from previous crimes. Shortly afterward, DeSalvo was arrested. After he had been picked out of a lineup, DeSalvo admitted to robbing hundreds of apartments and carrying out a couple of rapes. DeSalvo then, in 1965, admitted to being the Boston Strangler and carrying out all 13 killings while he was being held by the police at Bridgewater State Hospital awaiting trial. He was evaluated by psychiatrists and given the name of an attorney to use, F. Lee Bailey. And if you recognize his name from somewhere else, it's probably because he was a member of O.J. Simpson's legal dream team that defended him for murder in the mid-1990s. When DeSalvo's wife heard from Bailey that her husband had admitted to being the strangler, she couldn't believe it and thought that he was only saying it to get money from the media. George Nassar, a clever and extremely dangerous killer, and DeSalvo became friends while they were both inmates at Bridgewater. It appears that the two had an agreement in place to divide the reward money that would be given to anyone who could identify the strangler. DeSalvo wanted to financially make his family stable because he knew that he would be spending the remainder of his life in prison. Bailey questioned DeSalvo to determine whether or not he was actually the infamous murderer. He was stunned to hear DeSalvo explain the killings in such minute detail, down to the furnishings in his victim's apartments. It was all figured out by DeSalvo. He thought he could persuade the psychiatric board that he was insane, which would allow him to spend the remainder of his life behind bars at a hospital. After that, Bailey could publish his memoir and earn much-needed income for his family. Bailey describes how DeSalvo was able to evade capture in his 1971 book, The Defense Never Rests. The police were searching for Mr. Hyde, and DeSalvo was Dr. Jekyll. After a second visit and listening to DeSalvo describe in grisly detail the murder of 75-year-old Ida Erga, Bailey was convinced his client was in fact the Boston Strangler. When he asked DeSalvo why he chose a victim of that age, the man coolly replied, quote, "Attractiveness had nothing to do with it." Both Effley Bailey and the police were sure they had the killer after spending many hours questioning and getting into the details about the clothing the victims were wearing or the layout of their apartments. When DeSalvo recounted an attempted attack on a Danish girl, it was a startling revelation. He saw himself in a mirror as he was strangling her. He released her and begged her not to call the police before fleeing because he was horrified by the obscene vision of what he was doing. Police never filed any charges against him for that crime because his statement was the only evidence they had to go on. In a separate case, January 1967, 35-year-old DeSalvo was found guilty of sexual assault, burglary, and robbery, and was given a life term. He was held captive at Massachusetts Walpole State Prison, which is now known as MCI Cedar Junction. In November 1973, his doctor received word that DeSalvo needed to see him right away. He had to tell him something crucial about the Boston Strangler murders. No one knows what that information was or why it was so important that he needed to meet so quickly, because the evening before the doctor was set to see DeSalvo, he was stabbed to death in jail. Albert DeSalvo was dead. Because of the level of security in the prison, it was assumed that the killing had been planned with a degree of cooperation between employees and prisoners. Whatever the case, and although there were no more murders by the Strangler after DeSalvo had been arrested, the Strangler case was never closed. Despite his confession, DeSalvo's assertions that he was the Boston Strangler were disputed by those who knew him well and with whom he had previously collaborated. Richard DeSalvo, Albert's brother, said to Newsweek in 2001, quote, "Albert wasn't an angel, but he wouldn't go out and kill somebody." DeSalvo's confession contained inaccuracies and material that could have come from other sources, as noted by skeptics. DeSalvo's family and a nephew of Mary Sullivan, the final victim of the Strangler, pushed for officials to resurrect the case and seek forensic testing to establish DeSalvo's guilt or innocence decades after the killings. DNA tests were performed on DeSalvo's exhumed corpse in 2001, and the results were compared to semen discovered on or near Sullivan. After a forensic investigation showed a familial match, the request for re-evaluation was made in July of 2013. This time, research showed that the semen discovered belonged to DeSalvo. At the time, Martha Coakley, the Massachusetts Attorney General, stated that Albert DeSalvo was most likely the Boston Strangler, and that the verdict, quote, "leaves no doubt that Albert DeSalvo was responsible for the brutal murder of Mary Sullivan."
It is Ryan here, and I have a question for you. What do you do when you win? Like, are you a fist pumper, a woo-hooer, a hand clapper, a high-fiver? I kind of like the high-five, but if you want to hone in on those winning moves, check out Chumba Casino. At ChumbaCasino.com, choose from hundreds of social casino-style games for your chance to redeem serious cash prizes. There are new game releases weekly, plus free daily bonuses, so don't wait. Start having the most fun ever at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18+.